Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. This is from a bio blurb about today's guest, Howard Bloom, by Alex Burns on disinfo.com. Howard Bloom began his legendary career in music public relations when he co-founded the Howard Bloom Organization Limited in 1976, which subsequently developed the careers of Michael Jackson, Prince, Kiss, Billy Joel, John Cougar Mellencamp, Simon and Garfunkel, Bette Midler, Joan Jett, AC/DC, Talking Heads, and Grandmaster Flash, and the Furious Five. During the Tipper Gore and Parental Music Resource Center music censorship scandals, Bloom fought courageously for freedom of speech and democratic pluralism with his Music in Action Coalition. Bloom left the music industry in 1988 due to chronic fatigue syndrome, reinventing himself as one of the world's leading scientific experts on group dynamics, perceptual engineering, mimetics, and popular culture. His best-selling book, The Lucifer Principle, A Scientific Exploration into the Forces of History, was acclaimed by 22 major scientists upon its release and is regarded as a landmark study of principles including memes, the pecking order, and the superorganism. The book established Bloom as a scientific expert in mass behavior. Bloom subsequently founded the prestigious International Paleopsychology Project, a growing assembly of scientists, theorists, and conceptual outsiders who critically examine contemporary society, drawing upon physics, microbiology, paleontology, endocrinology, neurobiology, anthropology, history, and human ethology. Bloom shows this remarkable interdisciplinary outlook in his latest book, Global Brain, The Evolution of Mass Mind from the Big Bang to the 21st Century, which argues for group selection theory and compellingly warns that humanity may face a bacterial apocalypse. This is the second half of a two-part interview.
I had been out of the scientific establishment for so long that I hadn't really spent any time with scientists. I'd simply spent my time burying my head in books and absorbing all the latest research information. And the dogma of the time was based on the arithmetic of a man named William Hamilton. Came up with the idea that we do things in order to satisfy the needs of our genes, that if my brother's drowning in a river and I go in to save him, it's because he shares half my genes. If, on the other hand, you're drowning in a river, I don't go out to save you, it's because you don't share any of my genes. It's gross oversimplification, but that's the way the Hamiltonian arithmetic goes. And the Hamiltonian argument was wonderful because it helped us explain things like honeybee societies, where you've got 40,000 individuals who are working with very closely together, who are willing to sacrifice their lives in any way necessary on behalf of the group. Why? They all came from the same egg layer. They all are daughters of the same mother, the same queen. So if they do something that kills them but keeps the rest of the colony going, they've just saved more of their genes than they could ever toss into the next generation on their own. And the same thing applied to groups of ants that live in colonies of up to 20 million. Well, when it came to ants and bees, all of this stuff was very, very useful. But what I didn't realize was this particular approach to things, this arithmetic of genes, had been established as an orthodoxy. It had been established as a creed in science. So when my first book came out, The Lucifer Principle, which was finished in 1988 and then updated at various times and finally came out in 1995, and a review came out in Nature, and the review in Nature said there is no need whatsoever to pay any attention to this book because this book promotes an idea called group selection, and we all know that group selection was disproven as ridiculous hogwash back in 1964, end of review. I got angry. Can we say this on the radio? Pissed off?
Sure.
And I wanted to do something about it. This was not only, it was a violation. I grew up in science. At 10 years old, science became my religion. It was the fact that I had a religion in which I believed that allowed me to throw God away at the age of 13. And that religion was science. And the two things that I learned from sitting there reading two books a day, science at the age of 10, were, A, look at everything in the world as if you've never seen it before. When you're pouring water into a glass, watch it the way it splashes, watch things that nobody has ever bothered to look at. Watch for things that everybody has always taken for granted and see them with new eyes. And from those new eyes and from the wonder and the amazement and the awe that you achieve through this process, new questions will emerge. And that's what will carry you forward in science. When Hamilton came up with his arithmetic, it was an arithmetic system. It was violently incorrect. It didn't really relate to the reality of genes. It showed a violent disregard for the actual nature of a genome, which is a highly complex thing. For example, if my brother is drowning in the river, and I go out to save him, what am I saving? I'm saving somebody who has 99.9999999% of my genes, right? Makes sense. If you're drowning in a river, I jump in because you also share 99.999% of my genes. My brother shares an extra maybe dozen genes, possibly even as many as 100 that you don't have, but in a genome of anywhere from 40,000, which is now the canonical figure, to 100,000, which is a figure that's been bandied about more recently, but in a team of anywhere from 40,000 to 100,000 genes, you and I share 98.6% of our genes with a chimp. There's a good reason for us to jump into a river and save the chimp, too. It even turned out that Hamiltonian arithmetic, the arithmetic of the selfish gene, did not work in the case of bees and ants. It had a great validity. It carried us a certain distance, but then we had to go further. Why? You know that queen at the center of the colony in a beehive who's busy laying all these eggs so that all of her progeny are sisters? Well, that queen, when she first became mature, went out with all the other queens in the neighborhood, left her nest, and went to a central sort of dancing spot in the air where she mixed and mingled. It was a get-together of a sexual nature. She mixed and mingled until she found mates who were appropriate to her, and she copulated with approximately 7 of them. She came back to her hive. It was a long, hard struggle. Only one to six queens who try this, who go flying out of the hive in the hope of finding sex and then finding a new home, only 1 to 6 of them survive. But if she was one of those to survive, she was carrying the semen of 7 different males in a little sack, a little repository, like the cold storage that we use in sperm banks. So when she started giving birth to her daughters, when she started laying her eggs, every one of those eggs was different. Yes, it carried her genes, but there were 7 different strains of the male line being carried in those genes. So the Hamiltonian arithmetic, which said that all the genes were identical, didn't work out in any which way. It didn't reflect the reality of this enormously complex thing called a genome, the gene team, and it didn't reflect the actual arithmetic even of a beehive or an ant colony. But these things are useful way stations. They carry us a certain distance, and then we have to go beyond them. Problem was, it was absolutely taboo to go beyond Hamiltonian arithmetic. It was a thou shalt, you cannot break. To break with the Hamiltonian arithmetic. A, Hamiltonian arithmetic gave the scientists, the evolutionary scientists and evolutionary psychologists, balls. That is, it gave them a set of equations they could work with, which allowed them to claim to be scientists. Well, hang on a minute here. There's a guy named Charles Darwin who never used an equation in his life. He had no aptitude for it whatsoever. His aptitude was for observation and then drawing conclusions from what he observed. His aptitude was for pulling together ideas from different streams and seeing how they coalesced. Arithmetic had nothing to do with it. And Darwin is considered a legitimate scientist. He was an amateur. He was a person who, in a sense, had no credentials in science. He was credentialed by virtue of the knowledge he generated and the insights he generated and the data that he gathered. So my friends in the scientific community had gotten what it is to be a scientist all wrong, too. And they had mistaken religion for science. Once you dogmatize an idea, and once you tell people, if you mention group selection, you will never be published in a journal again. If you are never published in a journal again, you will be tossed off tenure track, and your career will be over. That's the situation I found when I came back into science. It's chilling. It's like the Spanish Inquisition.
One of the people that I've read in this area is Francisco Varela, who talks about the concept of autopoiesis. And it seems one of the issues for individual versus group selection, we're going to get to the applications in a second, is what exactly is an organism? I mean, the body is made up of a bunch of cells that cooperate together.
Right.
And then a group is made up of a bunch of humans who cooperate together. And then a country is made up of a bunch of individuals and groups who cooperate together. So at what point do you draw a boundary around something and say, this is an organism which competes against other organisms and passes on its characteristics? And as your book shows, the individual organism has a lot of features in common with these larger organisms.
Right. And I agree with everything that you just said. I think you put it very, very well. This is a universe of emergent properties. And emergent properties are things we could talk of as flickering fantasies, or we could talk about them as realities. A proton is an emergent property that comes when you join three quarks. Now, if you looked at it from a certain point of view, you could say, hey, there is no proton. All there are three quarks, so that would be rather ridiculous. A proton and a neutron together we'll get to what they are in a second. 300,000 years into this universe's life, protons and neutrons would discover that they had a strange attraction to these little things, 18,050 times smaller than they were, called electrons. The electrons would begin circling the protons, and we would have a new emergent property. That new emergent property is called an atom, and so on and so forth right on up the line, to galaxies, to stars, because galaxies came before stars, to planets, to macromolecules, and the macromolecules that make for you and me. Right now, you, a collection of 100 trillion cells working in concert, are talking to me, a collection of 100 trillion cells working in concert, and the two of us are communicating with an audience of, let's say, anywhere from 10,000 to a million people, each of whom is also a collection of 100 trillion cells. Should we look, if we were looking at things in the neo-Darwinian manner, we would say, hey, you know, first of all, atoms don't exist because they're just quarks. B, if you're made up of atoms, then molecules don't exist because they're just collections of atoms. And C, if you claim to be made up of cellular material, that's false because you're just a collection of molecules, and so on and so forth. But here's a real irony and a kicker for you. Every single one of these neo-Darwinists, as they're called, the people who are into the selfish gene concept and Hamiltonian arithmetic, every single one of them is like you and me, made up of 100 trillion cells. Okay, that's one big irony, but try this one on for size. 50 trillion of the cells of you and me don't even claim to be us. 50 trillion cells of you and me are bacterial colonies. Colonies of trillions of individuals constantly communicating with each other and acting as massive societies. There are more bacteria in just one colony in your gut than all the humans who have ever lived. And there is a community of these mega nations, these mega tribes of bacteria. There are a large number of these different bacterial colonies working within us, and they are making our vitamin P's, our vitamin K, and a whole bunch of other vitamins with which we cannot live. Plus, there are all kinds of foods that you and I can't digest. What do? We chew them. We pass them down our esophagus to our stomach, and we let the bacteria take care of the problem. The bacteria are then able to digest these foods, and they excrete exactly what we need. They excrete the fuel for you and me. So we're in a universe where emergent properties cannot be denied. They're the new realities. And the emergent properties of nationhood, which came about in the late 1700s and early 1800s, are now hard and fast realities. If we don't pay attention to those hard and fast realities and do it pretty quick, we can die. We could have easily lost our society, and many of us, especially me, I'm Jewish, would have died had Hitler had his way in the Second World War. These clashes between cultures and clashes between societies, like the clash between Islam and the West, that's been going on for the last 1,350 years and is in a particularly interesting state of froth and fizz at this point in time, we would have to say these things don't exist if we were going to go with the neo-Darwinian flow. But how do you say that Islam doesn't exist? That's a rather absurd proposition. Any scientist who says that a clear and plain phenomena doesn't exist ceases to be a scientist.
The idea that groups compete against one another and pass on characteristics, and that individual behavior can be explained as the in terms of group selection as opposed to individual selection. Does this have a political ramification? I mean, some people on the left are very skittish of any biological, sociobiological, or competition-based argument because of the history of social Darwinism or the reaffirmation of capitalist survival of the fittest. Of course, on the other hand, there was Kropotkin, who argued that group selection could argue for the naturalness of socialism and anarchism. For you, does arguing for group selection have a political upshot, or is there a radical disjuncture between is and ought in this
case?
Well,
the is and ought, you caught it. That's the truth. Now, here's how it works. If you come to understand something scientifically, and if your ideas are accurate, it helps you analyze your realities in new ways and come up with new solutions. It doesn't dictate an ethic. Science does not dictate an ethic. When you say that seven bacterial colonies, each composed of trillions of individuals, will make war with each other in order to get at a piece of fecal material 5 miles off the coast of New York that's been dumped as raw sewage, the warfare between those five colonies of bacteria does not necessarily indicate that we humans should be at war all the time. The fact that these bacterial colonies use chemical weapons against each other and are ruthless in dealing with each other doesn't mean we should use chemical weapons and be ruthless. However, it's very useful for us to know that the folks who assigned the Seville Statement back in 1991, this large group of social scientists, who said it is absolutely verboten in science to talk about violence. It is absolutely verboten in science to talk about competition. Well, they turned science on its head. They made it a religion instead of a science, and they were wrong. And as long as they keep their heads buried in the sand, they're going to have no idea of what to do about Osama bin Laden. They're going to have no idea of what to do about all of those Osamas, would-be Osamas, who have been shaped by his role model and are at the moment doing strange things, like the Egyptian who popped into LAX, the airport in Los Angeles, a couple of days ago, and did something whose motivation is so clear that it's ridiculous that the FBI should be quibbling about it. He's grown up in a society that has learned and taught the hatred of another society. So no matter what the source was of his disturbance, he went out to the boundary of one society and took his equivalent to a bacterial chemical weapon and used it. It was two guns and a knife. And he specifically used it on Jews because anti-Semitism is preached as gospel in most of Islamic society today, and preaching as gospel using the same books that Hitler used. Now, it's not politically correct for us to admit this. It's not even supposed to be politically correct for us to know this. But I'm a scientist, and scientists have to know these things if they're going to arrive at accurate conclusions. Plus, you and I are both human beings who live on this planet and have to make moral decisions every day. And even though science can't dictate our moral decisions, science can inform our moral decisions and tell us a little bit about how we do handle the Osamas and how we do handle the guys like the Egyptian who went on his rampage at LAX a couple of days ago.
So speaking of which, I just want to point out that in The Global Brain, which was published in 2000, you have a section where you talk about the rise of Islamic fundamentalism and how much of a threat it is. And you say here, the oppression and aggression of the United States and its protectorates, you're quoting someone who says that it has no end. It's time that they pay, and it's time that their people taste torment. And then you say, meanwhile, America, target number one, slumbered in a state of ignorance. So you're very prescient about that.
Well, the Lucifer Principle, which, as I said, was finished in 1988, also warned this would be the major problem of the turn of the century.
But you think that you argue that fundamentalisms and other kinds of ideological closure are a constituent element of the global organism that's emerging, of national organisms. You call them conformity enforcers or Spartans.
Right.
So, I mean, this is, again, one of the classical problems with functionalism in social theory is that you can't just look at something and say that, yes, it may be functional at one time and one place, but it's not always functional. I mean,
right.
Sometimes things can become dysfunctional. So is your analysis that in our current global epoch, conformity enforcers and this Spartan culture, fundamentalisms of different kinds, that they have become a dysfunctional and rampant or cancerous development?
Well, I can't make that claim because science does not allow you to make this kind of value judgment. The one thing, whatever wins, wins. But as a human being, I can answer that I prefer a pluralistic society. My religion is science, and science depends on pluralism. It absolutely depends on pluralism.
But as a scientist, you can say that it might kill us.
It very well might kill us, but then battles between democracies, wars between democracies are also killing things. And those have occurred from time to time in the history of this planet. So, yeah, I'm against war. However, if somebody is going to try to slit my throat, I'm all for self-defense. If, for example, here's an unpopular point of view, but if, well, we know that Iraq is working on nuclear weapons. It's been working on them for a very, very long time. I have an Islamic friend with whom we discuss these issues. I discuss these issues constantly. And immediately after 9/11, he said, look, you guys have got to do one, you guys, meaning non-Islamic Americans, have got to do the following. You've got to take out the nuclear capabilities of Iraq. You've got to take out the nuclear capabilities of Syria. You've got to take out the nuclear capabilities of Libya. And you've got to take out the nuclear capabilities of Iran. And you have to do it now. Because if you don't do it now, 3 years from now, it's going to be too late, and you are going to be dead. Absolutely going to be dead. Because these radicals within these societies are the ones who control the societies. They have kept their moderates from even speaking moderate beliefs. You could literally have your throat cut in most of the Islamic world if you try to enunciate moderate pluralistic beliefs. That's considered un-Islamic. Un-Islamic is a death sentence. And I'm not exaggerating. These are things that the news, our newscasters, should be telling us about night after night after night. They're not.
Let me return to the Izzat for a second, because I think a lot of folks who adopt the global brain or of kind of the global integration thesis have a kind of quasi-mystical approach to it, which is teleological and which merges ethics and observation together.
I agree with you totally. That's what New Age. That's why I get upset with New Age.
Right. And it's very difficult to maintain that because on the one hand, as you say, you're making certain observations, but you also say, for instance, totalitarian Spartans must be stopped by pluralists. This is a task which falls to our centuries, Athenians, upholders of diversity in a sea of harsh conformity. Now, you're not saying that because there is a global brain, we are dictated by the global brain to do this.
Not at all.
We're saying the global brain could end up in any number of different formations.
Absolutely.
But we may need to make an ethical judgment about what kind we want.
And in fact, our ethical judgments will play a very important role in the next decisions this global brain makes. One of the points or key phrases in global brain is the game subcultures play. And it says in global brain that subcultures compete with each other to take control of the eyes and ears of a society. Well, the subculture that has taken over the eyes and ears of Islamic society is the radical and fundamentalist subculture. It rules utterly in the Sudan. It rules utterly in Iran. It can tyrannize the governments even in Malaysia and Indonesia, which are two of the most modern and pluralistic of the Islamic countries. It tyrannizes in Pakistan. It tyrannizes in Egypt. Egypt, which is the intellectual center of the Islamic world. Remember, the Islamic world kept the flame of culture alive for 1,000 years while it was dead in the West.
You're in a unique position because of your background to answer this question. Is mass Western culture, I mean, there's this thesis that McDonald's versus jihad.
Right.
Is mass Western culture, pop culture, the unifier and the principal way to undercut this kind of Islamic fundamentalism?
It's a unifier and a differentiator. What do we use music for? We use music to show we're a part of one tribe and you're a part of another. The people who are into the tango right now are very different from the folks who are still into goth. They're very different from the folks who are into techno and dance music. Each of these forms of, and they're very different from people who are listening to either the Carpenters or who are listening to the oldies from the 60s. Each of these groups is using its identification with a certain form of music to say that it's different from other groups. And yet, something like, even something like Britney Spears, as much as I'm not wild about Britney Spears, I certainly respect what the people around her have done in building her as a figure. And a Britney Spears can have a wide international influence. She can have an influence in Russia. She can have an influence in China. Look at Harry Potter. Harry Potter, again, the novels that we read are also our ways of showing we're different from other people. We're part of a little subgroup. And at the same time, showing that we are... together, we're bonded with people who share our points of view. Well, the Harry Potter series, which does this for an awful lot of kids, validates their identity and shows them that they're a part of a larger group, has been so popular in China that in China they've just issued a bogus fifth Harry Potter book, and it's a bestseller. So international culture like Harry Potter can cut way across cultural boundaries.
Even before the Taliban fell, there was an edict that you were not allowed to have the Leonardo DiCaprio haircut because bootleg copies of the Titanic had become the most popular cultural product in all of Taliban Afghanistan.
Amazing. Well, so there you have it. We have, first of all, there's a Bloomian saying, which I don't think I've put into any of my books yet. I'm not sure. It's called opposites are joined at the hip. You know, usually in science we get into these little dichotomous debates. Either something is or isn't. Either pop culture is a grand unifier or pop culture is a great divider. Well, I got news for you. It's both. It's both. It's a great subcultural differentiator, and at the same time it's a great unifier. But we need, as it says in, you know, you were alluding to the pentad of a complex adaptive system that's laid out in Global Brain. First of all, a complex adaptive system simply means societies operate as if they were supercomputers, that you have a brain with 100 billion neurons, I have a brain with 100 billion neurons, there are 265 million of us, all of whom have these brains with 100 billion neurons, and when you put all of the brains together, what you get is a parallel processed computation machine, a parallel processed envisioning and creation machine. It's a computer that goes far beyond any sort of computer we've ever been able to make in silicon, and these computers battle it out. They duke it out with each other. Iran also is a parallel distributed processing mechanism. It's also a group brain, and these group brains battle, and it's through their battles that new creations, ironically, are formed. I seem to have wandered from the point here. What was the question, Jay?
Well, actually, we need to bring it to a close. And so let me bring up one final point, and that's the conclusion that you have in The Global Brain. You talk in The Global Brain at the end here. Let me quote it. Deep ecologists and fundamentalists urge that our faces point backward and our eyes turn down to contemplate a man-made hell. If stars step constantly upward, why should the global interlace of humans, microbes, plants, and animals not move upward steadily as well? And you argue that we have a mission, and again, this is not the ought part, but this is the ought part of your message.
Right. That we have a mission to create because we're star stuff incarnate.
Right, and that we are the universe appreciating itself.
That's
right. And that we need to spread life to the stars. That's a very inspiring vision. Of course, many people in the techno culture share your vision and the need for a space program, and hopefully we'll have more of that. How do you feel? Optimistic? You sound like you're kind of perennially optimistic person.
Well, we have to be optimistic because the only people who are going to do anything great are you and me. Einstein, who did something great, was just a little person like you and me whose nose ran and who got sweat on his upper lip when he shouldn't have, when a television camera was trained on him, and had all of the weaknesses, you know, itched sometimes when he was wearing a wool shirt. And yet he left a great legacy, a great heritage. And so did Galileo, and so did the founding fathers who put together the Constitution of this country. They were all just little tiny people with itches and scratches and insecurity, just like you and me, which means very simply that the future is for you and me to make. And I mean literally you and me and every person listening to this. If all of us don't visualize a future and go for it with all of our might, we won't have a future. However, there's such an incredible future implicit in us if we just bring our creative forces to life, if we just imagine what we'd like to see happening in this universe and do whatever small steps we can to achieve it, that we are star stuff incarnate. We are the universe taking the next step into evolution. It doesn't take any mysticism. There's no wishful thinking here. If you and I work diligently at making this a more zesty, creative, frothy place and also defend our society against those who would slit its throat, we can achieve incredible things.
I've been speaking with Howard Bloom. He's a Renaissance man, as one can tell. He's available on the web at howardbloom.net. And in two books, The Lucifer Principle and The Global Brain, both available from Amazon.com. Thank you so much for joining us, Howard.
It's been a pleasure, Jay.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.